The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Tonight, we're fortunate to have with us two distinguished practitioners of the sister arts of fiction and history. Sister arts because each is concerned with storytelling, memory, and finding a way to truth. And distinguished not only because the authors have won numerous awards for their work, but distinguished for the cogency and quality of their prose. Bruce Cummings will speak first. Cummings is the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of History at the University of Chicago. His first book, The Origins of the Korean War, won the John King Fairbank Award of the American Historical Association, and his most recent book, The Korean War, released in consonance with the 60th anniversary of the conflict, has been called a powerful revisionist history of America's intervention in Korea, a bitter pill, a sobering corrective. Chang Rayleigh will be our second speaker this evening. He is professor of creative writing in the Lewis Center for the Arts at Princeton University, and as you know, the author of the best-selling novels Aloft, A Gesture Life, and the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award winner, Native Speaker. His latest book, The Surrendered, has been called the most ambitious and compelling novel of his already impressive career. It is a gripping and fiercely imagined work that burrows deep into the dark heart of war, leaving us with a choral portrait of the human capacity for both barbarism and transcendence. Please welcome our first speaker, Bruce Cummings.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Andy Kahn and the Free Public Library for inviting me. It's an honor to appear with Chang Ne Lee, whose books I've admired so much. And it's nice to be back in Philadelphia. It's been a long time. I started my teaching career at Swarthmore College, and I have to say, at that time, with Mayor Rizzo and various other influences, we didn't come down to downtown Philadelphia a whole lot. But I'm so happy when I visited Philadelphia recently to see how impressive the downtown and the restoration of the downtown has been. I just want to make a few remarks about the Korean War and the book that I wrote, which for me is the first time I've ever written a short book about the Korean War. I didn't know it when I was younger that if you write a 600-page book and then follow it with volume two that's 900 pages, most people aren't going to read it. They're not going to buy it. And even libraries aren't going to stock it, libraries. But I had been in the archives so long and done so much research that I thought, okay, you readers, you're going to read all of it. So that was wrong. So Random House asked me if I would write a short book on the Korean War a couple of years ago, and I thought, what better venue than the Random House Modern Library for a book on the Korean War. It's very odd that there are so few books that you can assign in a classroom on the Korean War. There are a number of good books that are relatively short and readable. They're almost all out of print. In fact, they are all out of print, and I know that because I teach a course that deals with the Pacific War, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War, and I always have trouble finding books in print on the Korean War that I'm willing to assign to my students. David Halberstam, who did a book on the Korean War, it was his last book before the tragic accident that took his life, was in Key West and went to a public library and found 88 books on the Vietnam War and 4 books on the Korean War. And my own experience is the same. I mean, at the University of Chicago, we have racks and racks of books on the Vietnam War and maybe one rack on the Korean War. So it is a war that has been somehow eluded from the post-war period and from history, and yet it was an extremely important war, which is one of the points I'd like to get across. the first point I want to make is how easy it is to get into a war and how devilishly hard it is to get out. I was just watching the news about Libya and what our exit strategy, what is our strategy, and then what is our exit strategy, and should we take out Gaddafi, and all of this was being debated. In August of 1945, the State Department decided that it needed to occupy Korea or a portion of Korea because it was worried about some 30,000 Korean guerrillas in Manchuria in northeast China that would flow into Korea after the end of World War II and presumably would also do Soviet bidding because most of them were communists or claimed to be communists. And so the day after the Nagasaki bomb hit and obliterated that city, on August 11th, 1945, Dean Rusk and a colleague drew the fateful line at the 38th parallel in Korea, dividing Korea, and it remains divided today. The State Department wanted a preponderant influence by the United States in Korea and had really developed these plans almost within 6 months of Pearl Harbor, not so much because they were interested in Korea, but because they thought Korea had a very important relationship to post-war Japanese security and post-war Pacific security. There were only about 200 Korean guerrillas left from a bloody, murderous campaign that lasted from 1932 until around Pearl Harbor in Manchuria. But one of them was Kim Il-sung, who was a major leader of those guerrillas in the 30s, and a bunch of other allies who essentially returned to northern Korea and colonized that regime, put their kids through the best schools, intermarried with each other. They became the North Korean elite, and they're still the North Korean elite today. The entire legitimacy of the North Korean regime rests on the guerrilla struggle against the Japanese in Manchuria, and it still remains something daily palpable in that there are signs for young people live like the Japanese guerrillas. So Kim Il-sung was the problem in 1945. His son and even his grandson are the problem today, and the U.S. hasn't found fundamentally a way to deal with that. I think, like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we plunged into a political and cultural and even civilizational thicket that we didn't know without knowing the enemy that we faced. Today, very few well-informed Americans, for example, reporters for the New York Times, are even aware that the U.S. occupied Korea not in 1950 when the North Korean invasion occurred, but 5 years earlier after World War II with the division of Korea and a three-year military government that was set up and that deeply influenced South and North Korean history in the post-war period. David Halberstam in his book, and I have to say, I loved David Halberstam. I would have traded places with him. I mean, here's a guy who did really interesting books on Vietnam, on the auto industry, and he also followed around the Chicago Bulls for a year and wrote a book about it. And he was going to interview Y.A. Tittle, the quarterback for Baltimore Colts, when he was cut down in that auto accident. But I thought his book was a typically American book in that only two South Korean names appear in the entire book, and it just completely elides South Korean and North Korean history. He treats the American occupation of Korea in one sentence, when in fact it resulted in the most American-shaped or American-sponsored government in post-war East Asia. Let me make another point. At the beginning of my book, I talk about Robert McNamara dying a short while ago, and the New York Times, both editorially and it's and on the op-ed page, said, you know, how could he live with himself because he knew we couldn't win the war, and yet for years he kept sending tens of thousands of American soldiers to fight in Vietnam. But they also quoted him as saying that what he had learned about the Vietnam War after he was defense secretary was that we need to be in the shoes. We need to put ourselves in the shoes of the enemy. We need to understand their outlook on the world. We need to have empathy for them. And I quoted this at the beginning of my book. Even saying empathy, let alone sympathy for North Korea, would get you in trouble in this country. So I used a German word that nobody really understands, but it's called Verstehen, of trying to fathom what the enemy thinks and what makes it tick. And I said we still have never really done that with North Korea. You have a combination of do-it-yourself stereotyping by Kim Jong-il, who is, along with Gaddafi, the weirdest leader in the world, particularly in his sartorial display. But on the other hand, I think reasonably understandable in that he was his father's eldest son. In Korea, the eldest son is the privileged son. The second son died in a tragic accident in the late 40s. And for North Koreans, it was clear that Kim Jong-il was going to supersede or follow his father from at least 1970 all the way until 1994 when it finally happened. And so one thing I'd like to get across about North Korea is that Korean political culture has deeply infiltrated that regime. You have a Confucian monarchy smuggled into a communist system, and it's entirely predictable that Kim Jong-un, the grandson of Kim Il-sung, would be being touted for succeeding his father right now. I first went to North Korea in 1981 when 16 or 17 American scholars who specialize on Korea were invited for the first time since the Korean War. I came in from China. I wanted to go out through the Soviet Union. I wanted to go on the Trans-Siberian Railway. I had no visa to go to the Soviet Union, and so I went to the Soviet embassy, and instead of giving me a visa, they wanted to talk to me about what I was doing in North Korea. And a very personable individual who spoke Korean very well and was obviously one of their Korean experts met me three times for 2 or 3 hours each time seeking a visa, and he plied me with cognac and asked me what I was doing here and said something that nobody else had ever said to me. He said, well, we know who you are. You're a professor from so-and-so, but who's behind you? And I said, I really don't know besides, you know, being an assistant professor who hasn't gotten tenure and a wife and a kid. You know, I don't know who else is behind me. But he thought the CIA or somebody was behind me. But he said something that has been, ever since 1981, the best prediction I've ever heard about North Korea. I had seen the Sixth Party Congress where Kim Jong-il comes out and sort of choreographs the behavior of all the officials. And I said, well, I mean, he looks just like his mother. He's 5'2". His father's more than 6 feet tall. He doesn't look very impressive. He's, you know, just not like his father. And this Russian said, oh, you Americans, always thinking about personality. You should come back in the year 2020 and watch his son take power. They've got a knot of people in the bureaucracy behind him. I suppose that's some Russian word that I don't know. I don't know Russian, but a knot of people, and they're all going up with him. And what has happened in the last couple of years is simply that because of Kim Jong-il's stroke and his illness, they've hastened things. So it's very important to understand that North Korea, I think, can be understood in reasonable terms, not that it's a reasonable regime, but it has a history. It has a background, and most of our media are just terrible at dealing with North Korea in any serious way. There's hardly any investigative reporting. Kim Jong-il is constantly put on the screen. All last summer there was, on CNN, whenever they talked about North Korea, it was under the rubric North Korea threat. So I suggest in the book that this is really a species of Orientalism, forwarded by Kim Jong-il himself, and that it's really important for us to get behind that and try and understand this particular adversary. I'd like to mention in the 5 or 6 minutes remaining some unknown aspects of what I think is fundamentally an unknown war. The Korean War is called the Forgotten War in this country. And even before it was over, it was called the Forgotten War. I found a reference in U.S. News and World Report when what Chang-Nae Lee calls the trench warfare of the second 2 years of the Korean War was going on. People forgot about it. It wasn't raging across the peninsula. It was essentially around the it was around what is now the DMZ. And Americans stopped thinking about it, or at least most Americans did. But the war got very unpopular in those in the second and third year in 1952 and 53. And in fact, Harry Truman was the most unpopular president in public opinion polls until George Bush beat him in 2007. I think 27% was Harry Truman's rating in 1952, a little higher when he actually retired, and George Bush at he hit a nadir of 23%. I think one of the hardest things for South Koreans to stomach, and this is another aspect of this unknown war, is that the democratic, vibrant civil society that you see in South Korea today had very little to do with the kind of South Korea that you had in 1950. And in particular, in the forces of order, in the army, and the ubiquitous national police. The Japanese, during their colonial rule, had set up a paramilitary force called the National Police, somewhat like the Guardia Civil in Spain, that just intervened everywhere. Most of those people, most of those Koreans who had served the Japanese then came into the American occupation in the late 40s and worked in the police and the military. The high command of the South Korean Army was almost entirely composed of officers who had served in the Japanese military in World War II. And this is in a situation where Koreans had suffered under, particularly the last 10 years of Japanese rule, one of the most brutal forms of colonialism, particularly infused with racism against Koreans. In 1949, if you can imagine it, when the U.S. had 500 advisors in Korea, but the occupation had ended a year before the war began, the 38th parallel was controlled by a commander named Kim Sok-won in the south. And Kim Sok-won had been designated by the Japanese to lead the special Kim unit to chase down Kim Il-sung and kill him in Manchuria. So you have essentially a Benedict Arnold of the Korean people being in charge of the 38th parallel in 1949. On the North Korean side, North Korea is typically depicted as a creature of the Soviet Union, if not a puppet of the Soviet Union. In fact, we have a huge captured archive that I and other scholars have used from North Korea from 1945 to 50. MacArthur, you will remember, marched into North Korea, went all the way to the Yalu River, and then marched back rather quickly, but he didn't come back empty-handed. There are several thousand boxes full of open and secret documents in this North Korean collection. And there's one particular document that is a top-secret compilation of the backgrounds of more than 800 officers in the North Korean Army around 1948. And something like 600 of them had fought in China with the Chinese communists in the Civil War or in the anti-Japanese war during World War II. So North Korea's relationship with China has always been very close. Kim Il-sung had very close allies in the Chinese Communist Party. That's one reason North Korea hasn't collapsed in spite of 20 years of prognostications that it was on the verge of collapse. It has a very big ally in China. So anyway, you had people who fought in the resistance in North Korea who were creating a Soviet-style state in its structure but were close to China. Not a good outcome from an American point of view and probably not from a Korean point of view. And in the South, you had a dictatorship much weaker, led by and large, except for the President Syngman Rhee, led by people who had done the bidding of Japanese imperialists. So that's a very important aspect of the Korean War that should have alerted our intelligence people to what was coming, but really didn't. A second aspect is the extraordinary brutality of this war. In my book and in other scholars' accounts, the Korean War is compared to the Soviet Union in World War II or Poland in World War II. where as much as 25% of the population is killed. That was particularly true of North Korea because of very heavy bombing campaigns for 3 years. South Korea also suffered terribly. Families were separated. People were jailed. People were killed by the hundreds of thousands. And I find it, as an American, very difficult to write about this because it's fundamentally a Korean problem that they need to resolve still. And in a book that I wrote some 20 years ago, my first, it was 20 years ago. Time is getting by me. A 1990 book, I dealt with the issue of atrocities, but I felt it wasn't central to the origins of the war and what I was writing about, and so I should tread lightly on it. But since South Korea democratized, they've had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission modeled on the South African one that has examined vast numbers of political killings in South Korea, both before and during the war. The numbers are really astounding. More than 100,000 killed before the war, somewhere between 100 and 200,000 killed in the first year of the war, mostly for political reasons, and mostly by South Korean forces of order. They believe that the ratio of South Korean to North Korean atrocities is 6-1. And that completely violates, I think, what the American conception of South and North Korea might be. I think also Americans would really have trouble looking on the American role in the war, particularly the air war, because incendiary bombings that were perfected against Germany and Japan by the British and the Americans in World War II, it really happened around 1943 that they discovered that instead of conventional bombs, which might destroy a defense plant and have some collateral damage, they wouldn't destroy a town. But incendiary weapons, especially in proper atmospheric conditions, would destroy an entire town in minutes. So Würzburg, for example, went up in 17 minutes. We all know about the Dresden bombings because of Kurt Vonnegut. In Tokyo, in what is today a very... It always was a poignant and terrible thing, but it may be even more so. On March 11, 1945, 80,000 people died in the firebombing of Tokyo in one night. March 11th is also when the earthquake and tsunami hit in the Sendai region this month. In the case of North Korea, this enormous apparatus of firebombing was visited upon a country that couldn't compare to Japan or Germany in terms of its industrial power, although North Korea did have a lot of urban and industrial cities, and just about every one of them was leveled. By 1952, the whole society was living underground with hospitals, schools, factories underground, and North Korea has been building underground ever since. In 1999, our commander in the South said that North Korea has 15,000 underground facilities of a national security nature, 15,000, and almost their entire military is underground so that planes fly into the side of mountains. And that's because, whether during the Korean War or now, they haven't been able to control their own air and defend themselves. And after 1958, when the U.S. put nuclear weapons into South Korea by the hundreds, they had no defense against that except to build deep underground. I don't know if you were here in Washington. So many of you probably know the DuPont Circle subway station, where you go down, 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 and wonder when you're going to get to the bottom. The North Koreans, on my first visit, took me to their subway system, which is modeled on the Soviet subway system. So you have chandeliers and inlaid tile murals and all of that. But what struck me was going down, 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 very deep, until you finally get to the bottom of the escalator. And then you look to the right and left, and there are three gigantic blast doors about this wide, recessed into the walls. And so, trying to be friendly to my hosts, I said, well, those are probably for nuclear war or something, right? I mean, you probably bring those walls out and shelter people down here if you fear that you're going to be bombed. And they looked at me like, don't even expect an answer to that question. But it reflects the North Korean siege mentality, which is, I think, quite overdone, but at least in the 50s and 60s, perhaps more understandable, that the U.S. is capable of raining terrible destruction on them almost at a moment's notice. Let me close by saying that those of you that want to read my book, I hope you'll read the last couple of chapters, which no reviewers that I have seen yet seem to have mentioned. I hope maybe they've read them. But it was very hard for me to do because I try to get something across and I always feel like I'm only getting halfway there, but the subject was history and the temper of reconciliation. That when you read about 100,000 people being massacred or terrible air wars or an invasion that has still affects both Koreas 60 years later, history can be liberating, I think, when you know the truth or when you seek the truth for the best possible methods using archival resources, forensic methods in the case of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Korea, I mean, digging up graves and seeing what happened, so that the victims have a chance to speak, the perpetrators have a chance to speak, the documents speak, so to speak, and people can look back on a terribly unfortunate episode and think, well, we now know what happened, and let's put that in the past and move on toward reconciliation in the future. Covering things up, which the North Koreans have done ever since. I mean, they've shown absolutely no interest in an honest rereading of their own history, let alone the history of South Korea or the war. They're still covering things up. South Korea did that for 40 years. It just buries memories and resentments and causes ghosts of war to wander and torment people. A friend of mine named Henik Kwan, who is Korean, wrote a book about the Vietnam War called Ghosts of War. It's just a tremendous book. I recommend it to all of you. And he's now working on Korea. But many Koreans see the ghosts of their lost ones. They reappear in their dreams and torment them. But these kinds of memories and mental states can be put to rest or can be eased by an honest recapitulation of what really happened. South Korea, I think, has done more than any other nation in the world to use democratic dialogue to heal the wounds of 40 years of dictatorship, to let the silenced people have their say, try to establish the truth through the best methods, and thereby provide a basis for eventual reconciliation with their brothers and sisters in the North. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce. It's really great to finally meet you. I've been reading your work, and I'm so pleased that I got to share the stage with you. I mean, he's really such a valuable and leading scholar of Korean, contemporary Korean history, and particularly the war. So I really urge you to take a look at his books. Really wonderful. What I'm going to do tonight is just read a little bit from my novel, The Surrendered, and read a little scene that was in some ways inspired by something that happened to my father. Like a lot of Koreans, he and his family were moving about a lot in the first months of the war in 1950, and they were moving about, you know, in many ways, on foot, and the lucky ones in vehicles, but many in on trains. And they were these trains were cargo trains, just box cars, and so they were full of people and moving very slowly through these valleys. And at times they would have to sit on top of the trains. Because there was just no more room inside. And this scene is not a scene that happened to my father, but just inspired by, you know, his experience of riding atop those trains. And the character in this book is named June, and she's traveling in this scene with her twin siblings, who are quite young, and she's remembering what happened to her mother and sister before. But she's just traveling with them, just the three of them, alone now. The twins were fast asleep. June was flagging too and hungry. Sometimes the pangs overwhelmed her at night after her siblings were asleep, and only then did she allow herself to softly whimper and cry. By the morning, her spirit had hardened again, her mind already scrambling, angling furiously as to how they would eat for the day. They were constantly famished, the hunger risen in them like well water during the spring rains, accruing to them each day until the feeling, oddly enough, was like an unbearable plenitude, this pressing flood of hollowness that would not recede. In the beginning, in those first days on the march, when they had still had some money, they might buy rice and dried cabbage from others, her mother making a simple soup or gruel in a small tin pot a former neighbor had kindly given them. Because they'd had no time to gather what they'd packed, they had much less than most of the other refugees. At first, they did not dwell on the circumstances, for they were surely only temporary, for everyone was quickly moving southward toward the rumored refugee camp set up well behind the front, where people said there was plenty of food and tents. Once, a column of American trucks had rolled by, the soldiers tossing oranges and candy to them, and they could believe they would be all right. But soon enough, within mere days, there was little anyone could sell them, or, if someone was willing, a cup of rice or some strips of dried squid would be so costly that their money was practically worthless. And so the five of them, her mother and older sister and the twins and herself, took to foraging and scavenging, leaving the road for a part of the day to gather whatever they could in the countryside, greens and roots, wild berries and seeds, and then always checking any abandoned or destroyed American armor or trucks, however dangerous that might be, for whatever had been left behind. The Americans seemed to have unlimited supplies and were generous and profligate with them. Of course, everyone else knew the same, and so it was pure luck to happen upon a vehicle before it was completely, instantly stripped. One afternoon, the twins made a thrilling find, spotting the tail rotor of a helicopter that had crashed behind a bombed-out farmhouse. It had been there for at least a week, to judge from the remains of the pilots scattered about the wreck, the birds and rodents and feral dogs having worked to leave them almost cleanly skeletal inside the torn uniforms. Broken beer bottles littered the floor of the cockpit. But in a crate behind the seats, there was a hold of pristine riches, a half dozen packets of beef jerky and a can of Spam. As with the tins June had found earlier, they couldn't help but eat the canned meat right away. Their mother refused it, professing not to like its smell as she cut the pinkish block into four thick slices with the edge of the can, though while she was gorging on the salty, slick meat, June saw her mother take a taste of her fingertips, her eyes half shut, losing herself for a moment in another time and place. The days on the road were like that. You could never anticipate what might happen next, the earth-shattering and the trivial interspersing with the cruelest irony. You could be saved by pure chance or else ruined. That was the terror of it, what kept June awake at night and stole her breath through the day, though it was the terror that was also forming her into her destined shape, feeding the being of her vigilance until it had grown into the whole of her, pushing out everything else. It happened soon after the twins found the helicopter. It was a beautiful, shimmering day, the sky majestically tufted with high clouds, the slightest cooling breeze filtering down from the hills. Because of the solid nourishment, they were feeling stronger, more lively, and they were covering good distances, the younger ones having less trouble keeping pace. And their mood was light as could be given the circumstances. An especially haggard-faced woman traveling in their column had even given her brother, Jiyoung, a soccer ball, of all things. It had been the prized possession of her own son, who'd succumbed to a terrible infection several weeks before. They traveled all the way from Pyongyang, most every meter on foot. The woman had two daughters with her, and all of them were bearing heavy loads on their backs, and she'd held on to the ball, but it was a burden, as it was impossible to pack, and she was hoping to give it away to another young boy. and was somewhat deflated but almost new, and June's mother at first balked at accepting it for the very reason of having to carry it. But Ji-young was jumping up and down, and she couldn't bear to refuse him. Soon enough, they would stop once or twice a day, and they would play in whatever patch of field was around, often other children joining them for a kick or two before their families called them back. June's mother and older sister, Hee-sung, watching them from the embanked road. Everyone was exhausted and hungry, but it was joyous, for a moment at least, to simply watch the children play. That day they were playing with others when a column of trucks in light armor rolled through. It was the communists, heading north. It was said the Americans were pushing them back now from the small foothold they desperately held around Busan, and the North Koreans were in full retreat. Several hours later, a troop of soldiers followed, numbering only in the dozens, scuttling through them in a labored, steady march. The soldiers' condition was poor, some of them worse off, it seemed, than their own civilian ranks, a good number of them wounded, at least every fourth or fifth man unarmed. Still, they paused there long enough to demand food from the refugees, having everyone open their packs, and Hee-sung, who was carrying the beef jerky, decided on her own to slip down off the road and join the soccer game to safeguard the food. The packets of dried meat had been tightly strapped to her chest with a long bolt of muslin. They were careful to keep it hidden, given its great value, taking it out only under cover of night when they could huddle together and gnaw the delicious strips in secret. June's mother had been binding her chest anyway, for at 14, Hee-sung's breasts were already full and womanly. She'd cut Hee-sung's hair short, too, as well as June's, rubbed their faces with dirt each morning, and dressed them with school caps like boys, for there was always that certain danger. They'd witnessed soldiers from both sides kidnap other women and girls, some of them as young as June. They'd simply grab a girl from the ranks and drive off with her, and if she was lucky, they wouldn't kill her afterward, abandoning her someplace not too far away where she could be found or still make her way back. When one of the soldiers reached June's mother, she stood up and immediately gave him a tiny pouch each of barley and rice, saying she had only one other for her entire family. He was a corporal, judging from the bars on his uniform, and he shouted for the other one, and she gave it to him, whimpering. But June knew she'd just hidden much more than that, in a sock of pantyhose beneath her feet and in the tips of her rubber shoes. The soldier pocketed it, and he and his group were about to move on when he saw the children standing silently about in the weedy field, the ball left idle between them. "Go ahead and play," he said to them. His face was dirty and unshaven, his uniform caked with mud and dried blood. None of them moved, and he yelled, "Play! Play!" One of the boys pushed the ball with his foot, and another passed it on quickly to Hee-sung, who awkwardly kicked at it. She had never played much soccer. The corporal muttered something and handed his rifle to another soldier and jumped down, talking about how there wasn't proper sports instruction in the schools. Two of his comrades stepped down with him. He motioned to Hee-sung as he asked for the ball and commanded, "Watch me." She tried to meld into the scatter of the other children, but she was older and taller than all of them. He made the ball play back and forth quickly between his feet and then crisply booted it with his instep to one of the soldiers, who passed it to the other. It went back again to the corporal, and he passed it on directly to Hee-sung, who bent down and stopped it with her hands. "What are you doing?" he said, exasperated. "Trap it and pass it back." Hee-sung hesitated, and they did it as he ordered, but when the ball rolled to him, he just let it deflect off his foot. His expression had stiffened. As he walked to her, everyone stood still, and June's mother began in desperation to call to him, though with an informal address, her voice sounding strangely youthful and demure. But he ignored her, and when he reached Hee-sung, he pulled off her cap and took a long look at her short hair. He then held her by the neck and with his free hand pressed up between her legs. She crumpled to the ground, trying to push him away, while June's mother was shouting for him to leave her alone, begging him. He finally released her, and for a moment it seemed he was going to strike her, or perhaps kick her. But he simply turned to mount the road again. Hee-sung had crawled away, but then the two other soldiers stood her up on her feet, saying she made for a pretty boy. The corporal told them they were moving on now, but they kept pawing her, if not roughly, handling her short hair, her hips, and now her chest. One of them, a soldier whose eyes were set very close together, like an opossum's, tested her there again, and then ordered her to take off her shirt. She refused. He slapped her and then tore violently at it, exposing the binding about her chest, as well as the hidden shapes within the layers. June's mother ran over to them, screaming, and the other soldier struck her with his fist, and she fell heavily to the dirt. She was momentarily dazed, and a front tooth was knocked out, her mouth and lip badly bleeding. And June rushed to her and dabbed at it with her sleeve, not knowing what else to do. She and the rest of the children were crying, as was Hee-sung. She was terrified, her skinny shoulders quivering. The corporal was looking on from the road. The soldier told Hee-sung to raise her arms, and he pulled the binding loose, undoing it from her as if from a spool. And midway through, the packets of dried beef fell out. "Well, look at this," he said, picking them up. He inspected the jerky and the labels. "Where did you get this?" She didn't answer. "What are you, some kind of whore for the foreigners? This is American food. Please, I just found those. What did you do for them to get such a present?" "Nothing. I never did anything. Please, I'm telling the truth." "Sure you are. Let's see what else she has," the other one said. There was nothing else. This was obvious, but the soldier undid her anyway, with a horrid, meticulous patience. Soon, she was completely bare on top, her breasts as pale as milk. She tried to cover herself, but he had her keep her arms high, and all she could do was hide her face in the nooks of her elbows as she sobbed. "Now there's some sweet fruit," the other soldier said. "She's mine," the opossum-eyed soldier told him, now grabbing her by the arm. "Maybe yours first." She seemed to lose control of her legs, and they practically had to carry her up to the road, where they flagged down a covered truck. The soldiers quickly came to some agreement with the driver, who motioned to the rear. Very few of the soldiers were lucky enough to ride in vehicles. But as they dragged her to the back, Hee-sung began to resist, her feet digging at the dirt road. The soldier lifted her and slung her over his shoulders and took her to the rear of the truck. She was pummeling his back, kicking her legs. His partner jumped up inside, and he handed her to him, and then got in himself. He shouted to the driver, but the truck didn't move. It had stalled while idling. The driver turned over the engine several times before it caught. It was then that her mother, who'd scrambled frantically up the embankment, reached it, and as it began to roll away, she held on to the tailgate, suspended on its edge. Hee-sung, screaming from inside, "Amma, amma." Her mother screaming, "Hee-sung ah." June was wailing too, as were the twins, who stood frozen beside her, but she couldn't hear herself for the terrible shrieking, their cries as sharp as if they were being flayed alive. But it was another sound that overwhelmed them, the roar of two silvery jet planes flashing by overhead. The planes flew in low, shaking the ground as they instantly spanned the length of the valley, then careened far in the distance in a long, banking ascent. They disappeared almost completely, but then June could see they were arcing back. Suddenly, the column of soldiers and refugees broke up and dispersed. People sprinted for the fields. The truck had sped up for a distance, but now stopped, and June's mother climbed aboard while the two soldiers and a couple others leapt out. But Hee-sung and her mother did not. They were embracing, kissing, clothing each other in their arms, before the terrible onrush of sound and light. When June opened her eyes, the truck was gone. There had been a thunderous explosion. June and the twins had been knocked over by the force of the blast. There was an intense pressure in her ears, and for several minutes she could not hear her own breathing. The planes had made only one pass, firing a few rockets, and then flown away. She'd instinctively crouched over her siblings, and when she stood and looked back at the spot, there was nothing but a burning half-chassis. She ordered her brother and sister to stay put, and she ran there, in perfect silence, her heart feeling like it would burst out of her chest. The rest of the truck was in small pieces, its parts on the road and blown for dozens of meters on either side. The section in flames lay at the rim of a blackened crater in the road that the explosion had dug 2 meters deep and many times as wide. But there was little else about. Later, she would hear one of the soldiers say the truck had been heavily loaded with munitions and that one of the rockets had directly struck the covered bed of the truck. She searched the field below the road and saw the rent bodies of two soldiers on the periphery. The one with the pinched eyes had a large, jagged plate of metal lodged in his neck, his blood staining the ground in a small black patch. The other body was headless, but otherwise untouched. And she was ready for the most horrid discovery. But as long as she looked, circling back and forth, she could not find a single sign of her mother or sister. There was not a scrap of their clothing, not a lock of their hair. It was as if they had kited up into the sky, become the last wisps of the jet trails, now diffusing with a southerly breeze, disappearing fast above her. Thanks.
So I have a feeling we have some questions. If you raise your hands, we'll get a mic to you. The gentleman right in front here, would you like to start us off?
Professor Cumming, what do you think of Barbara Demick's book about the refugees? And in that connection, what do we know about the public opinion in Korea? For example, is the mass hysteria that we saw after the death of Kim Il-sung genuine? And in connection also, is there a possibility of any resistance, as in Egypt and Libya?
I think Barbara Demick's book is a very good one. She's a Los Angeles Times reporter who has, for a number of years, been interviewing refugees from North Korea and who has read a lot herself.
That's called Nothing to Envy, right?
Yeah, yes. Nothing to Envy. It's one of the first things I saw when I went to North Korea were these signs saying, we have nothing to envy in the world. They have them in kindergartens and all over the country. Nothing to envy. She's interviewed really hundreds, if not thousands, of refugees, most of them now gathered in South Korea. And she has a very good sense of what makes North Korea tick. And so I highly recommend the book. I think it's one of the best in a genre that isn't all that good, I would say. She's really just about the best. I have no idea what public opinion looks like in North Korea. There's no possibility of conducting public opinion polls. What people like Demick find is that there is considerable dissatisfaction with, and there should be, with the awful events of the last 10 or 12 years, including the famine in the late 1990s. And a lot of this is directed at Kim Jong-il, who has been in power formally since 1998, but in effect since 1994 when his father died. When his father died, it was very interesting to me because I'm like everybody else. I can't predict the future. I don't know what's going to happen. I can only make my predictions to myself or to somebody else as to what I think might happen. But I had been at a conference in March of 1994 with a bunch of North Korean experts, and one of them said that as soon as Kim Il-sung dies, there are going to be riots in the North and they'll overthrow the regime. I had heard that a lot, but I hadn't heard it 3 months before he died. And then he died in June, and what happened was not riots, but an extraordinary outpouring of mourning in rather traditional Korean fashion. And I think that was more predictable than the idea that somehow people are going to riot and overthrow a regime that has a million men and women under arms. And that gets me to, one other point is that Demick does find that even among defectors who hate North Korea, they still have a certain kind of soft spot in their heart or reverence for Kim Il-sung, which may be the result of decades of propaganda or maybe just the result of Kim Il-sung having been able to project a more acceptable kind of leadership than his son, or a more popular kind. So, to get to the last point, I've been reading the North Korean news for the last month just to see if there's a Jasmine Revolution or anything going on there. And there hasn't been, as far as I know. North Korea is controlled tight as a drum. They do have internet access for the elites and for some students, but I don't think there are young people going around there with their Facebook and Twitter accounts. China had, these calls for a Jasmine Revolution that began shortly after Tunisia and Egypt erupted. And the authorities just landed with enormous force and ubiquitous presence. And I'm sure if there was anything in North Korea, that's what would happen. I think North Korea is different than the typical dictatorship in the Middle East in that you have a gerontocracy that thinks it's still fighting the Korean War, and that if they give up and let somebody else take power, they'll lose the Korean War. That may sound odd, but of the 23 members of the Politburo, 15 of them are more than 80 years old. Kim Jong-il is a relative youngster at 69 or 70 in that leadership. So there are people go back to the Korean War, and they conceive of themselves as still fighting the war because there's never been a peace treaty. It's a kind of fossilized communist regime, and I'm sure it will end someday and probably violently, but I don't know how.
Sir, I'll tell you what. I want to move on to somebody else who has a question here.
Simple answer.
Gentleman in front here on our right.
Mr. Lee, welcome back to Philadelphia. A couple of years ago, I was privileged to see you up on the fourth floor here. And I think the last time you were here, you were in room 108. So
I don't know.
I'd like to congratulate you on your ability to move down in the world, so to speak, number one. And Professor Cummings, we look at Germany after World War II, and it was 1945, roughly, to 1989, and the country came back together again. We look at Vietnam during the same period of time, and by 1975, the country was unified again. Do you see on perhaps the distant horizon the possibility of there being one Korea?
Well, it's a good question, and the two analogies that you drew are interesting because when hardliners are in control in North Korea, which is essentially always, or in South Korea, the preferable unification formula is the Vietnamese one, that one side will just take over the other, and it might be necessary to do that by armed force. In the 90s, after Germany unified, there were just many, many Koreans in the South who thought that the German unification formula would be a good one for Korea, and they talked about how much it would cost and all of that. My own view was that wasn't a good analogy because East Germany had an army, or more like a constabulary, that was 100,000 people strong. But in 1989, there were 365,000 Soviet Red Army troops in East Germany. We went there, my family and I. It takes a lot of barracks to house 365,000 troops. We went there in the mid-90s, and they were still, the barracks anyway, were there. If Gorbachev had mobilized those troops, you'd still have East Germany. In the case of North Korea, they have more than a million people under arms, and there's no foreign presence, so it's very hard to figure out what kind of plug to pull. Furthermore, East Germans had been watching West German TV for a long time. They could look at West Germany as having a social market system, so-called social market, that would provide them health care and retirement and unemployment and all of that, and you could even call it socialist. I mean, all the Republicans do. And so it was possible for many East Germans to think that they could survive and thrive in a context where West German laws were applied to their part of Germany. South Korea has done well recently in terms of social welfare spending, but it's nothing like West Germany 20 years ago. And so North Koreans have to look forward to a life of probably working in factories at very low pay. It's not as attractive. It probably is attractive enough if they had the freedom to choose. So I don't think those analogies are necessarily, well, the Vietnam one works. That's what the North Koreans would like to do still, is just use their huge military and unify the country.
And there are hardliners in the South who would like to do that as well, and that's the greatest danger in Korea. But I think the period when there was a real chance at reconciliation leading toward eventual reunification was in the 10 years from 1998 to 2008, when Kim Dae-jung became president, and then his protege, Nomu-hyun, followed him in 2 5-year terms, and there was a great deal of progress with North Korea, engaging North Korea, visiting North Korea. Tens of thousands of South Koreans went there. And I think that was pointing in a good direction, but it has been derailed under the current administration in the South and through North Korean belligerence. So we're kind of back at square one, but I do think that 10-year period really gives you a model for how a slow-moving Korean unification would work.
A few more questions. Lady about 10 rows back on the aisle.
A question for Mr. Lee. When you're writing about historical events, how faithful do you feel you need to be, you know, in terms of obviously you're writing fiction, but also using history and maybe real people sometimes?
Well, I wish I had Bruce next to me when I'm writing. I think for me, I don't write historical fiction. That's not how I think about it. But obviously, I want it to feel historically accurate and convincing. And I guess, so there's a slightly different charge, I think, for me. It's not, I'm not concerned as per this scene, for example. I'm not concerned with, any kind of troop movements, or I'm not concerned with a larger military or geopolitical picture. And this is not a book that's really interested in that. It's really actually interested in what happens to folks who experience such things. So that's the focus. But yet, I do have to make sure that I have a solid enough grip of certain events and certain operations and processes and historical record to feel as if I can, I would say, invent inside that context. So that means not just the larger things, but also reading enough about the smaller things, first-person accounts from service people or from Koreans about just little things that happened to them along the way on the road. There was this one account by a young American GI who was just landed in Korea, and it struck me, and I wrote another scene sort of based on it. But it was nothing, right? He knows nothing. He's just in this spot, and he's been tasked by a South Korean officer to execute a North Korean spy. He's the only American around, and maybe he's forcing him to do it just to make him do something. So he goes to do it, and he comes upon this fellow, and he sees that it's a frail 85-year-old man who doesn't look as if he's could hurt a fly. There's no evidence suggesting that he is a spy, and perhaps maybe he was just a political killing or some sort of, who knows what it was. But that's the kind of real-life testimony that gives me a sense of the kinds of things that realistically did pressure all these folks in that context, and the kinds of things that they really did have to deal with. And those are the kinds of things that, for me, are what I really want to get accurate, which is, the minute operations of a certain consciousness in that context. And I hope I got that right. I can't believe that he was making up that scene, and so I will write a scene that's not similar, not exactly the same, but perhaps has the same kinds of pulls and tugs and ironies. And I think that happens in every theater of war.
I'd just like to say something about that too, because our theme is supposed to be history and fiction, and fiction and history. The passage that Chang-Nae Lee read tonight is to me, it probably happened thousands of times, things like that in the Korean War, but it's very authentic. It struck me as when I first read the book as exactly right, as does the execution scene. I teach a course called Asian Wars, where I deal with the Pacific War, Korea, and Vietnam, and I assign one novel for each war, because I think often novels somehow will give the students a better appreciation of what really happened than history books or books by historians. Ha Jin's book, War Trash, which is, I think, a quite authentic novel about a Chinese soldier in the Korean War, is just a wonderful book. It's a very closely observed, honest, fair-minded book where Ha Jin takes everybody that he encounters to be a human being worthy of his concern and his intelligence. And I think it's the best novel that has been written about the Korean War, except China's novel isn't really about the Korean War. It's partially about it, but so much of it takes place elsewhere, so I'm not making invidious comparison. And Michael Hare's book, Dispatches, about the Vietnam War, is not a novel, although in the hardback version of this book, I said it was a novel, which was a Freudian slip. It's reporting that Michael Hare did from Vietnam and beautifully written. But when students read it, I tell them, well, this is what your parents knew about the Vietnam War, you know, the ones who experienced it directly and the ones who read about it, because he manages to put us right in the middle of it in a way that I think no history book can do. So I really think that a mix of history books that are firmly grounded and novels can really help us understand something like the Korean War.
I wonder why there hasn't been more fiction on the Korean War. I mean, playing on what you said, it seems like the novels that confront the Korean War that I've read, Surrendered, Lark and Termite, Indignation, yeah. Sort of they focus mostly on American aspects and bounce back and forth, but maybe with the exception of Ha Jin's book, which completely focuses on that.
Yeah. I mean, Indignation is a book about that takes Philip Roth back to the Midwest, not to Bucknell College where he went to school, but to Winesburg College in Ohio, which is a play on an earlier novel. There is no Winesburg College in Ohio, but he basically gets caught in a panty raid, and the dean kicks him out of school, and he gets drafted, and he ends up in Korea, where he dies. But I discussed that in my book, and it, along with a couple of other books that I discuss, both memoirs and novels, it's as if the war hit a glancing blow against that generation of people. It didn't get into their innards the way the Vietnam War did in to people in the 60s. And as a result, the novels never show much knowledge of what the hell was going on in Korea. So with Roth, it's always snowing, or he's in a mountain somewhere. It's very cold. And then he has another scene, and then it's very cold again. And that's about it. James Salter wrote a beautiful book called Burning the Days, which is about his, it's a memoir. Salter had wanted to be a World War II Air Force pilot, but got his stripes just as the war ended. And so his war was in Korea. And he has maybe four sentences about Korea in the entire book. It's like the bridges at Toko Ri, which is one of the best-known films from the Korean War. It takes place mostly in Japan, and Toko Ri is the Japanese pronunciation of a Korean village. So you're right. I mean, there just haven't been many novels that, at least in English, that deal with the Korean War. And in my book, I try to explain it, but I don't really have a good explanation of it. We ought to have more than we do.
Another question. Gentleman all the way back on the aisle there.
Thank you. My recollection is that we got into Korea as a police action, and that I don't have any remembrance of us actually declaring war. Did it ever occur? Was there ever a definitive point in time where the president went to Congress and asked for that?
No, and this came up with the recent Libya intervention because Congress wanted a role, wanted to be consulted at least. and under our Constitution, it's the Congress that has the right to declare war. Harry Truman, actually Dean Acheson, his Secretary of State, on Saturday night when the news of the war came, Acheson decided to take the war to the United Nations and get backing there, and told Truman he didn't need to come back from Missouri where he was at his home in Independence. And so it was really Acheson who pushed through the whole idea of going through the UN, not declaring war. And people like Robert Taft, the conservative senator from the Midwest, from Ohio, protested that almost immediately. But that set a pattern for every war since. We haven't had a declaration of war since December 8th, 1941. And it's a problem. I mean, I wrote in my book that Truman wanted a legislature where he knew he'd have the votes, and the UN was better than Congress for this. And the Soviet Union was boycotting the Security Council so they wouldn't be vetoing it. But it was a sharp, stark departure in American history.
We've got time for one more question. A lady in the middle there. Keep your hand up, please.
Hi, this is for Mr. Lee. In Native Speaker, there's a sentence, and I apologize if I can't remember verbatim, but it went something along the lines of Rome was the first Babel, New York was the next, and Los Angeles would be the last. And I felt it was extremely poignant, not only because the book was a narrative on immigration, but because of the central role played by Los Angeles in Korean immigration. But the city that you seem to be drawn to is New York, so I was wondering what New York meant to you in terms of, like, you know, geography of your narratives.
Well, certainly in that book, I mean, that book's about a lot of things, but it's also a love letter to New York. It was written at a time when I was very far from New York. I was living in Eugene, Oregon, and I missed New York a lot. And in many ways, it helped me, that distance, I think, helped me write about New York. I was living in New York before that, and I went to graduate school in Eugene, and I sometimes think that if I had been living in New York with all the stuff going on around you, that I might not actually write about the things I really needed to write about. Because sometimes you need to, often I think you need to write about the things that you really want to write about, not necessarily what's there. You know, writing novels is not about representing things. It's about representing something of your version of what that place is. And for me, New York, at least the New York of my wish and New York of my love, was, you know, this chaotic, lingually resplendent city that had all these people. And there's a certain, you know, chapter that starts out with all the hero takes a ride on the 7 train going to Flushing, Queens, and he's just looking out over the landscape and kind of recounting all the peoples that he's going to hear, that he's going to meet, all their foods and their languages and all that. And for me, that was my romance with New York. You know, I mean, obviously there are other things about New York that I enjoyed, but for the purpose of that book, that was the bell that I was seeing and missing a lot. So that's my New York.
Well, unfortunately, we have to end it there. If you haven't read The Surrendered, if you haven't read The Korean War, I urge you to read them. They are two very powerful books that get to the truth in through different media, but all through words. Please join me in thanking Chang Rae Lee and Bruce Cummings. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.